In 1978, my wife Mary and I were unexpectedly invited to work here in the United Kingdom, where I was to serve as a pastor in Birmingham. All the factors that led us to accept the call are still not clear to me, even after 32 years of living in this country. Why leave the security of friends, the warmth and sunshine of the tropics, the unabating energy of fellow Jamaicans, and the excitement of rapid church growth to live in a forbiddingly cold country where sunny days are celebrated as special gifts from God? However, we would not exchange the experience that we have had for anything. We were asked to work here for 5 years, and it's now nearly 32 years, so that tells its own story. We cannot forget how cold and overcast October 5, 1978 was when we emerged from Heathrow Airport to be met by a fellow pastor. As soon as we got seated in his gleaming Peugeot car, I asked him if he could take us to Reading, where we had to visit a bank. "Pardon me," he said in his deep Irish accent. I repeated the name of the town we needed to visit more clearly and slowly: Reading. And so began my orientation to life in the United Kingdom. "Ah, you mean Reading." I began to realize that things were not always what they seemed to be. Lesson number one, though I was a very slow learner. Coming from a country that I thought was the center of the world, I took it for granted that every Caribbean person in the United Kingdom came from Jamaica. And so early in my time here, I made the nearly fatal error of meeting a Caribbean person on the street and asking her proudly, "Where in Jamaica are you from?" The response was, to say the least, chillingly cutting. With eyes that in no way masked her indignance and her disgust, she said, "I am not from Jamaica." Lesson number two, do not prejudge. It was the middle of December, first December that we spent here, and I was due to take prayer meeting at the Handsworth Seventh-day Adventist Church, where I was the pastor. I looked through the window of the house that Mary and I shared with another pastoral family who had also just arrived in the country. Horror of horrors. The ground was covered with a thin layer of snow. I dutifully rang the church elder and informed him that due to the snow that had fallen, I wasn't able to travel to church that evening. The church was no more than 5 minutes away. The church elder must have said to himself, with a smile, "He will learn." Lesson number three, minor inconveniences are not an excuse for not getting on with one's duties and obligations. In addressing the subject of diversity in the British Union this evening, I could spend at least 45 minutes on each strand of diversity in our church. That would mean, however, that this would be the last time I'd speak at Newbold College. So I decided to address just one area, and that is cultural diversity. I could speak on gender diversity, age diversity, but time will not allow me to do all of that. When I arrived in the United Kingdom, as I mentioned earlier, in 1978, diversity was not a word that was used frequently within the Seventh-day Adventist Church. There was one major cultural distinction that was often highlighted: the differences between those who were called the indigenous, on the one hand, and the Caribbean members, on the other hand. Whenever that subject was being discussed, at least in the areas in which I moved, various negative motives were attributed to the indigenous. whom I prefer to call the majority population, for not worshipping with the Caribbean members. On the surface, the stated motives appear to fit the situation, but when one took a closer look at that situation, one came to realize that much of what was purported to be behavior arising from prejudice and intolerance was largely the result of cultural preferences. Things are not always what they seem to be. Some underplay the importance of culture in respect to worship, choosing to say that all people, if they're children of God, should worship together. If they don't, then the conclusion is clear. They are not children of God. In the dim and distant past, I did an MA in religion here at New Bolt. Mike Pearson was then a relatively young man, though I must confess he hasn't changed much since that time. My MA thesis was on worship and culture, and all my research and studies have led me to the view that worship is meaningful only within the context of one's culture. Worship is meaningful only within the context of one culture. According to Sherwood G. Lingenfelter and Marvin Mayers in their book Ministering Cross-Culture, culture is the label for the sum of the distinctive characteristics of a people's way of life. All human behavior occurs within particular cultures, within socially defined contexts. So what was construed as a reticence on the part of the majority population to fellowship with members from the Caribbean might have been nothing more than a desire to worship in circumstances with which they were familiar. Several Seventh-day Adventist churches in the British Isles are loosely described as Caribbean churches. However, when one takes a closer look at these churches, one is surprised to discover that most of these churches can be more narrowly defined than just being Caribbean or West Indian churches. In numerous cases, Caribbean churches are made up of people from a particular country or even from a particular village. The members of the two churches in High Wycombe, for example, are largely from one small Caribbean island, St. Vincent. Brixton and Balham churches can both be considered as Jamaican churches. Balham is not only a Jamaican church, but largely consists of members from one parish in Jamaica. And even beyond that, if you look more closely at the situation there, from a group of villages in that parish that are close to each other. A large number of the members of Balham Church are descendants of the Maroons, freed slaves in Jamaica, who were a thorn, sorry to say, in the side of the British, and who fought the British successfully until the British signed a peace agreement with them, which involved being exempt from paying certain taxes. I am a descendant of the Maroons, as is Val Allen, Val Bernard, known to some of you. So, perhaps Balham is the one church in the British Union that I would not choose to pastor. Too many neighbors, too many relatives are there. Then there is Leicester Central Church, an Antiguan church. Huddersfield and Chiswick are predominantly Grenadian church. So they are not just West Indian churches or Caribbean churches. So even within the seeming homogeneous Caribbean community, there are certain cultural differences which, to some extent, drive people to worship and fellowship with people like themselves. People who understand their humor, their linguistic quirks, their customs. If the Caribbean people coalesce according to their particular practices and their particular ways of worshipping and speaking and sharing a joke, they should understand that people from other cultures, including the so-called indigenous peoples of these isles, also wish to worship with people like themselves. People who sing like them, pray like them, preach like them, and understand their humor. Let me share with you a story that serves to illustrate how people from one culture can easily misunderstand those from another culture, even when they speak a common language. My son was in primary school, and he came home one day and reported to us that he was called silly by his teacher. My wife and I nearly hit the ceiling. How dare this teacher call our son silly? So the following morning, we were present at school.
Yes, sir.
How dare you call our boy silly? And so he tried to explain. It's kind of a term of endearment. There's nothing offensive about it. We were not going to have any of that. Please, don't ever call him silly again. Well, now my four-year-old daughter, granddaughter, says, "Granddad, you are silly." And I understand what she means by that. She means, really, I love you, Granddad. But you see how we can easily misunderstand each other. Now, where there is a mixed church, a congregation of cultures which are fairly equally distributed, leadership is presented with an enormous challenge to satisfy everyone. Oftentimes, they end up satisfying no one. I will come back to this later when I address the birth and growth of what we call ethnic churches in the British Union. Of course, a church of various cultures is the ideal in that it represents the fulfillment of the gospel commission, where people of all nations and kindreds respond to the outstretched hand of God. However, often the ideal is not possible, and we must make a pragmatic approach in addressing certain situations. So now I come to ethnic churches. In my experience, the dichotomy within the church between the majority members and the Caribbean people was the general context in which the church operated up until the early 1990s. In 1992, a group of Ghanaian members who worshipped in various churches in London and Reading, requested the South England Conference to recognize the existence of a Ghanaian fellowship and organize the fellowship into a church. The stated purpose of establishing a Ghanaian church was to keep Seventh-day Adventist Ghanaians who come to this country in the church and evangelize the wider Ghanaian community. And so was born the era of the ethnic churches, or as some call them, the culture-specific churches. Of course, some will be quick to point out that there were two Indian churches before this, one in Bedford and one in Birmingham. However, those churches created no ripples. They hardly registered upon the consciousness of members. It was the establishment of the London Ghana Church that caused a great stir among the saints, and which since that time has led to several discussions on the right and wrong of ethnic churches. As I travel around the British Union and open myself up to questions by members, I am asked more questions on this subject than on any other. Since the establishment of the London Ghana Church, several other ethnic churches have been established. Among them are eight other Ghanaian churches. East African churches, Portuguese-speaking churches, Filipino churches, Spanish-speaking churches, a Nigerian church, Russian churches, a Bulgarian church, Romanian churches, and several others. I have been ridiculed by some for allowing the establishment of ethnic churches and praised by others. Perhaps if I share with you why I supported and still support the establishment of these churches and even encourage them, you might think me less of a villain. In the early 1990s, there were close to 50 Seventh-day Adventist churches in the London area. All but two of these churches were predominantly Caribbean churches. The two exceptions were the Central London Church and Wimbledon. So, in a very practical sense, the Seventh-day Adventist Church in London was a monocultural church, a West Indian church. Nearly every church operated in the same way on Sabbath, all in a city that was highly multicultural. Another important factor was that in the early 90s, no more than 150 members in London would be considered people of European extraction. In other words, white. As I have already demonstrated, birds of a feather flock together. This is just a basic fact of life. If there were no churches in London with birds resembling the majority population, there would not be many birds from that segment of the society flocking to our church. I came to the conclusion that if our church was to be even mildly effective in London, it was necessary to change its monoculturalism to something that was somewhat monocultural. It was necessary to broaden the appeal of the church in London and provide different kinds of churches for different kinds of people. So I not only welcomed the establishment of ethnic churches, I encouraged their establishment. What would have been ideal at the time was to have the existing churches become multicultural churches, not merely in membership, but in the manner in which things are done. But that was easier said than done. You see, if we were starting fresh with 50 new churches in London where everyone could have a major say in the manner in which things were done, that would be possible. However, that was not the case. In nearly all the churches, there was already a long-established pattern of worship and witness. Those established churches expected all newcomers to fall in line and worship according to the long-established traditions. Yes, they were prepared to have an international day or evening from time to time, where the various cultural costumes and dishes are displayed, but worship had to be done in the way in which it had always been done. So, the only form of multiculturalism that was possible in those circumstances, practically speaking, was churches of different cultures. Now, if the Ghanaians went in their hundreds to the Holloway Church, Stanborough, or Hampstead, and worship in the manner in which they normally do, they would possibly be thrown out of those churches. And yet, there is something very beautiful and joyful about Ghanaian worship. Whenever I want my soul lifted on a Sabbath, if I'm not preaching, I'd go and sit there, because there is something very, very uplifting and joyful about that worship. But we don't necessarily have that in our West Indian churches and in our British churches. Tell me, in which West Indian church or British church would you find women sashaying down the aisle to present their offerings? and men rising spontaneously from their seat to express their joy, none that I am aware of. To force the Ghanaians to worship with the West Indians or the British would result in an approach to worship that would be neither chicken nor duck, and would be frustrating to many. The same goes for the Filipinas, with their fantastic vocal music, the Russians, who believe that whatever music is offered in church should be of the highest order, and all other ethnic groups. Should people from other cultures be forced to worship in the West Indian way, many of them would soon give up attending church, as many had before the advent of the ethnic churches. It is of some consequence that the ethnic churches are among the fastest growing churches in the British Union. In my last full year as president of the South England Conference, 2004, the Portuguese-speaking churches came top in the number of new members added by baptism. Now, that was a surprise to many who thought that it would have been a Caribbean church and possibly an African church, but it was not the case. It was the Portuguese churches that topped the conference in accessions. Today, the Ghanaian church that started with a membership of 49 has a membership of 600 and has given birth to 8 other Ghanaian churches. The story can be repeated with the other ethnic churches. I think we have about 4 or 5 Portuguese-speaking churches. Now, some might say that what I have just described to you is a form of religious apartheid. My response is not in any way. God forbid. There is no element of coercion in this arrangement. People are free to worship where they wish to. There are British and Caribbean people today who are worshiping in the Filipina church because they enjoy the form of worship there. The same can be said about the Ghanaian church and other ethnic churches. What would be immoral and wrong would be a written or unwritten code or law which requires people to go only to the church that represents their culture. What we have done in developing the ethnic churches has been to provide choice to worshippers and would-be worshippers. So reason number one for the ethnic churches is that a multicultural society needs a multicultural church. Reason number two is that church growth is more rapid in churches where their members are able to identify with a certain segment of the community who are like themselves. The third reason for encouraging the growth of ethnic churches will become apparent in a story I will now tell you. A member of the Stanborough Park Church was berating me mildly one day over the setting up of these ethnic churches. He was strongly of the view that it was wrong and that everyone should worship together. I calmly said to him, "Okay, I understand you. I will encourage the Ghanaians to close their church and to come to Stanborough Park." Well, that was the end of the discussion. He walked away like the rich young ruler, sorrowfully, for he wished to preserve the traditions of good old Stanborough Park. I trust that the inference is clear. I am not so naive as not to realize that ethnic churches do create certain challenges for church leaders and the church community. Sometimes they are seen as not being fully engaged with the program of the conference, as some other churches are, or are inward-looking, caring only about their own church community and not about the interests of the wider church. But interestingly, the same observation can be made of other churches, some of which display these very characteristics. Many of the traditional churches are not fully engaged with the program of the conference and care only about their own communities. So this is possibly more of a challenge for churches in general than it is for just ethnic churches. On balance, the benefits provided by our ethnic churches for mission fulfillment are, in my opinion, much greater than the drawbacks. In other words, they provide us with a much greater platform for presenting the gospel in our diverse community than would otherwise have been the case. I want to move now to the noughties. The noughties. That was the 90s. Between 2000 and the present, the British Union, in diversity terms, has experienced what I can only describe as a demographic earthquake, the likes which have not been seen since the church came to these isles. Biblical writer perhaps would say since the world began. Between 2000 and the present, thousands of Adventists arrived from Southern Africa and Eastern Europe almost overnight, or so it appeared. And the church is still struggling to address this seismic shift in its makeup and orientation. Let me briefly illustrate what I meant by a demographic earthquake. In the early part of the current decade, or in the early noughties, Luton Central Church was about 90% Caribbean and 10% a mixture of English, African, and others. Today, Luton Central is approximately 80% Southern African. The same phenomenon is repeated in scores of churches throughout the British Union. Southampton, which was the first Adventist church established in this country, I visited it about 6-7 years ago. At that time, it was a predominantly white English church. About 90% of the worshippers there then were from the majority population. I returned last year, 80% were from Southern Africa. Let me hasten to say that every person, from wherever they come, is warmly welcomed into the church in the British Union. No one must be in any doubt about this. We have endeavored to convey this to our pastors and to our local leaders. But the arrival of the members from Southern Africa has been good for the British church in several ways. Many small churches which were struggling for survival have been revived as a result of increased attendance. The musical ability of the new members has enhanced many a service, and their commitment to the mission of the church has been refreshing. Their warm and friendly disposition is also a particular blessing. Perhaps it is important here to make a distinction, and I hope that you understand objectively this distinction that I'm going to make now. Between the Caribbean people who came in the 50s and 60s and those who have recently come into the Union, especially from Southern Africa. Though there were some exceptions, the majority of those who came from the Caribbean were largely from the rural areas, uneducated people who came from the Caribbean, people like my own parents who came here in 1961. The situation is different today. Those who have come in recent times are largely very highly educated people. To give you an idea of what I mean by this, the church Dundee in Scotland, which I visited recently, has a membership of 55. Approximately half of the members there are from Southern Africa. Among that small band of people are six medical doctors. That's the kind of distinction we see between those who are now coming and those who came many years ago. Caribbean members became the majority in the church in the 1970s. That status is now under threat. Should current trends continue in another 5 years, in my opinion, the African members will be the majority in the British Union. There is at least a 50% chance that young people from the African and Caribbean communities getting married today in the church will marry someone of African origin. My three children who got married within the last 4 years are all married to Africans. Two to Southern Africans and one to a West African. 26 years ago, when I entered church administration, church leaders were primarily concerned about nurturing the members of the majority population and the Caribbean members, along with a small number of others from places such as Mauritius and the Seychelles. We were also concerned about reaching the British population with the gospel as preached by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. However, today, our concern is to minister to a wide spectrum of members without being partial to any particular cultural group. The church will never be the same again, nor should it be. We are all still very much concerned, however, with reaching the majority population with the gospel, from the viewpoint that they are 90% of the people living in the British Isles. I'd like to make a few general observations and then speak about certain measures that are being taken to address the diversity in our field. The newly arrived members from Africa and Eastern Europe have brought a certain vibrancy into the church. This is obvious in the singing in our church, the warm atmosphere that we experience from Sabbath to Sabbath. Secondly, the church, however, has become much more conservative as a result, particularly with respect to addressing other forms of diversity. One that comes easily to mind is gender diversity. Only a few months ago, I was speaking in our church in Walsall and took time to emphasize the equality of the service and ministry of men and women before God. Greeting worshippers at the end of the service at the door, kind gentlemen pressed a piece of paper into my hand and said, "Please don't read it before you get home." Of course, I was curious. So as soon I was through greeting the members, I opened it. And he said, "I want you to know, Pastor, I enjoyed the sermon, but I disagreed with every word you said about the equality of the service of women and men in the church." This is a particular challenge and a growing challenge that we are facing in the diversity that we find in the British Union today. The third important observation is that the task of reaching the majority population with the gospel has become much more challenging as a result of the diversity that we have today. The greater challenge has arisen from the increasing cultural dissimilarity between the church and the majority population. The British Union is one of the few places in the world where the composition of the church is in reverse proportion to the composition of the general population. So whilst in most other countries, witnessing comes naturally as people share their faith with people like themselves, here, faith sharing involves much cultural bridging. Another factor that makes reaching the majority more challenging today than, say, 10 years ago is the reluctance on the part of some of our newcomers to embrace some of the evangelistic methods that are seen to be more appropriate for reaching the majority population. Consequently, the Life Development Program, the Life.info magazine, and the philosophy of belonging before believing that are all part of our strategy for reaching the majority population are not generally supported by many of the newcomers who prefer a traditional approach. Speaking at a Big Deer Fellowship in the North to a group of members from Southern Africa, I spoke about the Life Development Program and other methods required to reach the majority population. And at the end of the service, a young lady in her 20s said she wanted to speak to me and said, "Well, all that you need to do is to pitch a few tents around this country and preach the gospel." Try to tell her we have done that and it hasn't worked very well, but she would not be dissuaded from her position. What are some of the measures being taken to address the diversity in the union? Well, we've had a number of diversity seminars where leaders of various culture groups have been able to dialogue with each other and seek to understand each other. Secondly, in hiring and appointing ministers, the needs of the culture groups, various culture groups, are being considered. Whereas 20 years ago, our pastors came from just two cultural communities, the majority population here in the British Isles and the Caribbean segment of the church today, the situation is markedly different. The cultural distribution of ministers largely reflect the diversity within our church today. Most pastors taken on in the last 10 years are originally from places such as Africa, Eastern Europe, India, and South America, not from the Caribbean. Sadly, not from here either. A close friend of mine usually asks the question, how many people does it take to change a light bulb in the Seventh-day Adventist Church in the British Isles? And he gives the answer himself. The answer is 4, he says. 1 Caribbean, 1 from the indigenous people, 1 African, and 1 representing all the others. In other words, we have to have balance in what we do. And then we have prepared a special edition of The Messenger. I hope you have seen this. And this is for a particular purpose. It is largely to give those who are coming into the church, especially from abroad, a feel of the Adventist Church in the British Union, helping them to understand that even though we have common beliefs, common values, Adventism expresses itself in different ways in different parts of the world. Of course, it goes without saying that all our new worshippers are welcomed warmly into the British Union. They are part of the family of God. And we ask our local churches to involve new members from abroad in the life of the church in order to heighten their sense of belonging. I'd like to close by sharing with you what I see are certain major implications of the current diversity seen in the British Union. The first is somewhat obvious, and that is that the church in the British Isles will never again be a monocultural church. Its course from here on is set solidly in a multicultural direction. While this might not be comforting to some, we cannot hide our head in the sand and believe that one day we will all return to some glorious past. It is not going to happen. The second is that the majority culture or cultures in the British Union have a responsibility to protect the minority cultures or the minority culture in the British Union. I have said much about the members from the majority population. They have become the minority. No more than 15% of the membership of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in the British Isles are from the majority population. The African and Caribbean members, who are currently the majority in our church, must protect the minority, meaning the members from the majority population. Let me expand a little on this. In the same manner in which the Portuguese-speaking members, the Russians, the Bulgarians, the Ghanaians, and others are able to worship with people like themselves, for reasons such as those that I stated earlier, members from the majority population should also be allowed to worship in a manner that they find comfortable and appropriate to their culture. The majority in the church have a duty to ensure that what they have in abundance is also available to the members and the people from the majority population, the indigenous segment of our church and society, and that the desire of those members to worship in a culture-appropriate manner is not seen as racism, but regarded with the same understanding and acceptance accorded to other groups. Then, if the church is to have a significant impact on the society, much emphasis is required on cross-cultural evangelism and outreach. Pastors and members will need to be trained and encouraged to witness outside their own culture, and perhaps there is a significant role here for Newbold College. The church also needs to be sensitive in its appointment of leaders and ensure that executive and departmental leaders reflect the broad cultural makeup of the church and the society. It's important that I add this, and the society, because our mission is to the society. The fifth and final implication is rather positive, and that is that despite the challenges the church faces here in the British Union, we can and should celebrate the richness and variety that people from nearly every country in the world bring to our common spiritual table. We ought to take the opportunity to explore and appreciate the complex interplay between people of different cultures and marvel at God's wisdom in making us one, but making us different. Thank you.